are also on trial. Mubarak faces the death penalty if convicted, although most of the testimony so far has distanced him from any order to kill protesters. State-run media outlets report his defense lawyers are demanding that officials linked to recent fatal clashes at Cairo demonstrations also stand trial side by side with Mubarak. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
A notable Hollywood passing today. The chimpanzee in the 1930s Tarzan movies, oddly named Cheetah, has died. He was 80 years old. The animal sanctuary in Florida, where he lived, says he died of kidney failure. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems. At pewtrusts.org.
As you make your year-end giving decisions, please consider a gift to WILL. Listener support is the heart and soul of this station, and your gift will help pay for the programs you rely on next year. Make a tax-deductible contribution online now at willpledge.org or mail a check to UIF/Friends of WILL, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning. For over 60 years, serving Champaign-Urbana's heating and air conditioning needs. Information at 367-5264. Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning encourages you to join them in supporting WILL.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus Archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. Pakistan has been one of the United States' key allies in its counterterrorism efforts. Yet the word ally seems not right, not quite the right word. In May, without informing the Pakistani military, the U.S. launched a raid resulting in the death of Osama bin Laden. And last month, July of 2011, the Obama administration announced it would withhold or cancel hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to the Pakistani military. Journalist Pamela Constable has reported extensively on Pakistan for The Washington Post. She has spent considerable time there looking deep into the fabric of life. In her new book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself, Constable offers a look at the nation through its people, including rural laborers, religious minorities, and the ruling elite. Pamela Constable, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Celeste. Nice to be with you.
My pleasure to speak with you. Why do you see Pakistan as being at war with itself?
That's a very good question. I would say that in many ways it's almost a schizophrenic society. You know, if you could imagine, it has a city like Karachi, which is almost like New York City, with skyscrapers and banks and commuters and lawyers and professionals and women wearing, you know, modern clothing and fashion shows. And then in the other extreme, you could be in a tribal village in which, you know, its life is as primitive as it was centuries ago, in which women have almost no rights, in which people don't have paid jobs. Many people are essentially working for other people for no money at all. They don't get a chance to go to school. They don't know what's happening in the world. Their lives are essentially as they would have been, as I said, you know, centuries ago. So that's one sort of snapshot of the extremes. Another aspect of this is that, you know, Pakistan has had a tradition of, it's a Muslim majority country, and it is an Islamic republic, but it's always had a tradition of very moderate and tolerant and peaceful ideas about Islam. And it's been very proud of this tradition. But in recent years, starting with the the war between Afghanistan and the Soviet Union, Pakistan began to be the recipient of more radical Islamic ideas brought in by religious groups essentially from the Middle East and other places. And that whole phenomenon has begun to grow. And it's continued to grow in recent years. And with it has come an increasing anti-American and anti-Western point of view, and you've had thousands of these very radical religious seminaries that have sprung up across Pakistan, and they preach and teach a very different version of Islam than the one that is traditionally associated with the country. Much more draconian, separation of a complete separation of genders, much more punitive in its notions of how to treat people. So what we are seeing now in Pakistan increasingly is almost, as I say in my book, a war for Pakistan's soul. It's a struggle between two very different notions of religion, of the dominant religion. And so you have groups that were once considered to be, you know, radical, you know, fringe elements of these extremist groups like the Taliban and others are now really moving more toward the mainstream. They are gaining more influence, not only by terrorism, but by literally having more influence on people's thinking. So that struggle that's taking place is really becoming much more at the heart of wondering what the future holds for a country like Pakistan.
Yeah, I was really struck by the opening of your book, where one of the things you say is that Pakistan contains 1,000 separate worlds that may coexist at close quarters but never intersect. So what do the missing intersections mean for Pakistan and its peoples?
And, you know, that's also a very good question, and it's not necessarily an easy one to answer. There are many, many diverse societies in the world. I mean, there are many, many large countries that have all different kinds of people in them, but the key is whether they're able to coexist peacefully. And one hopes that in the future this will be the case in Pakistan. But what's happening increasingly is that some of these groups are turning to violence. And so, you know, these kinds of differences, as long as there's the rule of law and as long as there is, you know, relative social peace, don't have to, you know, spell doom and gloom for the country. But the problem is that as the radical views harden and as more and more people who are sort of ordinary, average Muslims get caught up into this deeply emotional, highly defensive notion that their religion is under threat, that their whole way of life is under threat, this becomes a very alarming prospect. I mean, we're talking about the prospect of the armed militant fringe groups coming closer to the ordinary person and vice versa. And that is an arc that is very disturbing to contemplate.
How does the military view the situation?
The military is, I guess, sort of two minds. Traditionally, it has always felt or believed that it could contain and control and in some cases manipulate the radical, violent fringe religious groups. And the title of my book, Playing with Fire, refers in part to that idea that you had a military establishment and indeed a political establishment that thought that these violent Islamic groups were not a major source of concern for the country, that they were an oddity, that they were a sort of aberration, you might say, and that they did not present a threat to the society. And that's always been, generally speaking, the view of the military establishment. But in recent years, it's become clearer and clearer that these groups do present not only a threat, you know, to their neighbors, such as India or Afghanistan, but increasingly they present a threat to the state and therefore to the military as well. But it's only been in the past few years that the military has begun to turn its vision and begun to really face the problem. They no longer see it as someone else's war, but beginning to see it as their own war. And the first major example was when the military decided to launch an operation in the Swat Valley, which had 2008, which had always been one of the more beautiful, peaceful, a tourist attraction area up in the northwest, which essentially got taken over by the Taliban. And after this had gone on for some time, the military finally said, "Okay, we have to put a stop to it." And they went in and they had a very aggressive ground and air operation, and they did in fact push out the Taliban. And that has been followed by several more operations. So it's becoming more clear that the military does not want to tolerate these groups turning against the state. But still, there's still a deep ambivalence. I mean, remember, historically, many of these same militant groups were supported by the state because it wanted to maintain guerrilla war in Kashmir against India, and then again turning to Afghanistan against the Soviets. So some of these same groups that are now viewed by the world as terrorist threats are groups that were originally seen as freedom fighters by the establishment, by the army. That's a very hard change, a sort of mental change to make.
This is Focus. We're talking this morning with reporter Pamela Constable. Her book is Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. Let's take a call. This is a listener in Urbana on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. This is a very interesting discussion. And as I was listening to the last 5 or 6 minutes, as you described, for example, an increasing religious radicalization in Pakistan, and you know, the supposedly mainstream groups, and the army, and so forth, thinking that they could contain it. It sounded to me very much like what some people might see, I would see, as the situation in the United States today. I know that the United States isn't your thing, or at least in this book, but
it is my country.
it is your country. But I think, you know, for example, the rise of sectarian schools, whether it's Christian schools or Jewish schools or Muslim schools, and the rise of what we might call like-thinking enclaves in the United States. One could even think of some of the forms of domestic violence in the United States. For example, attacks on family planning clinics, murder of family planning doctors, and so forth, as forms of religious-based domestic terrorism that the FBI doesn't want to call terrorism, the Department of Justice doesn't want to call terrorism, and you know, the mainstream media won't call terrorism. And I just would like to hear you comment on that.
You raised a really, really interesting question, and it's one that I've actually thought about a lot. I remember, you know, years ago when there were some Christian missionaries in Afghanistan who were arrested. And in Afghanistan, it's not only not allowed to be a Christian missionary, but it's a capital crime to convert to Christianity. So these were people treading on very dangerous ground, and they were arrested by the Taliban. And I remember their families and even some of their pastors came to the region to express support for them and to try and help them get released, which they in fact eventually were. But I remember, you know, meeting his families and meeting the pastors and going to actual services that they were holding in churches to express support for these. Basically, they were young students who had gone into Afghanistan, and they described them as warriors for Christ. And it was sort of chilling in a way, because I realized that these young people were going into really enemy territory knowing that it was enemy territory, and they were going in with a very, very strong religious conviction of their own. Whether you agree with it or not, it was a very strong and dangerous thing to do. And that was, again, many years ago. And what I've seen since then, in many ways, happening in this country, there has been a parallel surge in, you know, what I call religious conviction and religiosity. It's happening particularly among Christian organizations, but others as well. But the difference that I want to stress, and it's something I said a bit earlier in the interview, is that differences are fine. In fact, differences are good as long as there is the rule of law and as long as there is relative social peace. And so what we're seeing in this country are incidents that have turned violent, and you mentioned some of the different kinds of them. But we're, there's no war here. This is, and hopefully there will be no war. Hopefully, even though we are at a time of rather sort of nasty public discourse and hardening beliefs and sort of more muscular and aggressive promotion of beliefs and religious views, it is my hope that this will not progress to the point that it has in some of these other countries like Pakistan and other parts of the world, because we do believe in the rule of law. We do believe in the Constitution. We do believe in keeping social peace wherever possible. Those still remain values that still have primacy in the United States, and I do very much hope that that will remain the case.
Mm. Let's take another call. This is a listener on line 2 in Champaign County. Hi.
Hi. I agree with the other caller that we shouldn't think of this situation as so entirely foreign. And I think we also need to, I'm afraid I wasn't able to listen too closely at the very beginning, but the depth of U.S. involvement with the elevation of Zia al-Haq, our favorite dictator, and even giving him a pass to develop the Islamic bomb, unquote, because he was compliant to fighting the Russians in this century's great game. At the time of the aid to the Mujahideen, et cetera. Since you are emphasizing sort of the ethnicities and the interest groups, Pakistan is just such an amalgam. A friend of mine goes to the region, and she was talking about how every Pakistan of any educational level knows about this map that was published in the Army Times some time ago by a guy named Peters, I guess. But it's a remapping of Pakistan with an independent Baluchistan. And most people here don't realize that, I guess we'll call it the neocon element, is so into, in this country, so into redrawing the maps that they actually think about, you know, isolating Iran from China and with the Baluchistan independent and apparently our side kind of thing. But Pakistanis think of it in these terms, and it's often characterized here as, you know, lunacy, but on their part, paranoia and conspiracy theorists. But the discourse does exist here, and I don't know. I'm preoccupied with the circumstance since we're spending so much money and blowing so many people of various ilks away. That I've read the book Descent from Chaos by Ahmed Rashid and The Duel by Tariq Ali, and I'm about to read one called Crossing Zero by Gould and Fitzgerald that I'm looking forward to a lot because I've seen some excerpts. And I just think the complexity, one thing they emphasize is that, you know, Pashtunistan is a viable concept. There are these, and the Punjabi Pashtun discord is a lot of what's underlies part of this dissension in the country, and the fact that the colonial boundary was driven, the Durand line was drawn, and dividing these Pashtuns into Pakistan, what actually the tribal areas. Anyway, that's a whole lot for you to even attempt to unwind, but I want to get some of those ideas out, and I'd like to hear how you would react.
Okay, let's let the guests tease that apart.
Yeah, you've raised about 20 issues in 5 minutes. I don't even know where to start. Let me start at the very beginning. When you talked about Zia and those early days, I mean, you know, the alliance between the United States and General Zia was strictly based on the Cold War, and his religiosity was something that was kind of overlooked rather than necessarily encouraged, and it just turned out that some of the guerrilla groups that we supported in Pakistan who were fighting the Soviets turned out to be among the most radical Islamic groups, which is very unfortunate, but it was not something, it was not intentional. It was a byproduct, and that byproduct has indeed spread across the region, but it was, I don't ever think it was the intent. And, you know, the Islamic bomb, you know, actually, if you go back, even Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, since you're so interested in history, who was a, you know, liberal, almost socialist, who was put to death by General Zia, also supported the Islamic nuclear weapons program. So it wasn't a partisan issue. It was a highly emotional nationalist issue, and every government from the 70s up till now has strongly supported it, both liberal as you can get and as conservative as you can get. It's a highly nationalist, nationalistic issue for the Pakistanis, and it plays right into your other point, which is that Pakistan is a very weak nation. It is a very, very fragilely bounded nation. It has very little in common, even though it was founded as a Muslim homeland. It has such enormous ethnic, linguistic, and regional differences, as well as religious diversity, that it's been very, very hard to keep the country together politically. It has had, as you mentioned, secessionist movements in both Baluchistan and in the northwest, where the Pashtun group is very strong. These have been going on. There's one in Sindh as well. They've been going on for a long time. And what has kept the country united has been the army, has been the fear of the outside world that has been very aggressively promoted by the army and other leaders, the notion that India is this great hegemonic enemy and Pakistan has to stay united to defend itself against that enemy. So that plays into the strengthening or the attempt to strengthen Islam as a uniting factor. And then the having a nuclear arsenal has been sort of the Islamic bomb. Is a very important uniting factor. It's something that everywhere you go in Pakistan, people are proud of. And so it's a country that has had a lot of cleavages, a lot of weaknesses. It's a country because it's very poor and diverse and scattered. It has huge desert areas. It's a country where it's very hard to get people to unite. They're not only different from each other, they never meet each other. And as you say, there's been all these pressures around the edge, all these secessionist movements, too complicated to explain in a short interview. But yes, those pressures are still very much alive, and the weaker the nation is, the weaker its political leadership is, and the stronger the pressures on it. Ahmed Rashid's book is a very good book, and I also enjoyed reading it. It tells a lot about the situation. You know, the more worrisome it is. I mean, on the one hand, you might say, well, we don't really want that strong a state because, you know, they've got the bomb, and what if they turn against us? On the other hand, the much greater danger, I would think, is if the state is so weak that it can't maintain control of the government, and if the government were to fall into the hands of, you know, a radical religious group, a secessionist group, one of the guerrilla armies that's out there, that's a much greater concern, I would think. I mean, even though a lot of the conversation now is about how our relationship is weak now, it's fraught with tensions, aid is being cut off, you know, the bottom line is, I think, that we are still two allied states, and I don't think that's likely to change. I certainly hope it doesn't change in the near future.
I want to thank the listener for his call. One of the themes that came across to me in the book was the gulf between the well-to-do and the rest of the country, the lack of social mobility. Is this part of the political discourse in Pakistan?
It is, but probably not as much as it should be. you know, one of the great disappointments about Pakistan, I mean, to Pakistanis, is that, you know, a succession of governments has not really done enough to try and eradicate poverty and even more importantly, to employ and empower and engage and educate its populace. And I often say that Pakistan potentially has all the possibilities of becoming a modern, successful, you know, democratic, even prosperous, or certainly developing prosperity in the future. But the problem is that, number one, because it's always devoted such a large chunk of its revenue to the military, the military budget has always been so high and always been kept high at the expense of social and economic spending. And number two, because it has been ruled traditionally by elites, small, very wealthy elites, who are essentially remained feudal, either in terms of owning a lot of land or also in their attitude towards the poor in many cases, that it has not allowed the poor and the lower and working classes to advance in terms of getting better education, finding better jobs. The economy is not strong enough or large enough to accommodate a rapidly growing population. There simply hasn't been enough attention to these problems, and they're growing rapidly as the population increases. You have huge rural poverty, which is now being compounded by growing urban poverty. The gap is widening. It's not narrowing as the population grows. So it seems to me, and I say this in my book, that, you know, it's hopefully not too late, but the leadership really needs to start focusing much more aggressively on trying to close this gap, or else things really could get much, much worse there.
Mm. It seems you've got a little bit of a tickle. Let me reintroduce the program and you, and let's let you get a little sip of water or something. Again, this is Focus. Our guest this morning, Pamela Constable, author of Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. Let's take another call now. This is a listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hey. You know, I was thinking about when you were talking about the difficulty in making this one nation in terms of the linguistic and the cultural differences. I think that's also maybe contributed to the rise of the type of Islam that is there, is that the government has used Islam to try and unify people in the country. I'm just curious what you think of that, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks for the question.
It's true. It's true. It's been sort of true in at periods of time more than others. One of the previous callers mentioned General Zia, who was in power from, I guess it was 77 to 88, and he very much tried to what he called Islamize the country. He introduced all kinds of new laws and policies that were aimed at trying to not only unify but strengthen and make more aggressive the kinds of Islamic policies, for example, in the education system, in the legal system, you know, across the board. He very much used Islam to try and unify the country. But actually, if you look at it historically, the divisions within Islamic groups in Pakistan have been as center stage and as much of a problem as the opposite. For example, there has been conflict for many, many years between the Sunni majority and the Shiite minority, although Shiites are a very large group and they're a very respected group. There has been terrible strife and conflict between them, and they've both Sunnis and Shiites have had basically armed groups that fought each other, you know, throughout long periods of time. The Christian minority has come under a lot of attack. Increasingly, in the past a few years, there has been, you know, some really, you know, horrendous attacks on Christians. There have been mobs that have, you know, burned down whole communities. There were two people, one Christian member of the cabinet, federal cabinet, and a governor who was defending a Christian woman accused of blasphemy against Islam, who were both assassinated early this year. And the shocking part of that was that in both cases, especially the assassination of the governor, there was a lot of popular support for the assassination, because many Muslims were convinced that that he was an infidel, that he was a blasphemer, and that therefore he deserved to be killed. So this is a very shocking and sort of new example of religious divisions that have been increasing in the country. And I'll mention one more group, the Ahmadi Muslims. This is a minority sect within Islam that is regarded as regarded as un-Islamic by the state, and is seen as very much a pariah group, officially as well as culturally. And they've also, the Ahmadis have been coming under increasing attack. So I would say that as the effort has grown to identify the state and the nation with Islam, which has essentially meant Sunni Islam, because that is the majority, and increasingly has meant more conservative versions of Sunni Islam, what you're seeing happening at the same time is increasing discrimination and physical attack against other religious groups. So so it's not working, so to speak. I think it's causing as much divisiveness and trouble as not.
You also write a little bit about the tensions between Sunni and Shia in the book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as I'd said, actually, in response to several earlier questions, it's been a complicated relationship, because there's a lot of Shiites in Pakistan, so they've always had a very, they've had a respected place in the society. There are plenty of political leaders, as well as religious and business leaders across Pakistan who are Shiites. So it's a minority that has enjoyed respect officially. But culturally and religiously, the worldwide, or certainly the region-wide conflict between Shiism and Sunniism have also been playing out in Pakistan from time to time, in certain places more than others, particularly in cities where there are large numbers of both sects. At particular times, for example, during certain Shiite holiday periods, there have tended to be more attacks against them when they're out in the streets and having one of their mass demonstrations or celebrations for their own holidays. They're both Sunni and Shiite groups have had armed wings or armed guerrilla armies that have fought each other or have tried to ambush and sabotage and assassinate each other's leaders. That has gone on sporadically and periodically in certain areas of the country more than others, at certain times more than others. But it's a permanent concern and a permanent undertone that has not gone away.
Mm. You talked with people who are feudal landlords, and you mentioned feudal landlords a few minutes ago in the interview. And in the book you report, all of these feudal landlords agreed that the system needed to change, yet they also defended the old ways and the status quo. Who are Pakistan's feudal landlords?
Well, Pakistan, unlike many other successful developing countries, has never really had what you'd call a major agrarian revolution or reform. It's never really undergone the kind of really radical change in the structure of land ownership that many of the more successful agrarian economies have. So there have been several sort of weak and limited land reforms that have increased the ability of, smaller farmers to buy land and have reduced the maximum amount of acres you can own. But basically, in many parts of the country, you still have most of the land owned by a few wealthy landowning families. And those families tend to be the same families from which local political leaders, local police chiefs, and local power elites come. So you have de facto control by many rural areas in Pakistan by the same families who are owning the land, who are holding the political positions, and who also have often positions of security authority. So it's a kind of as one of the people I talked to put it, it may not necessarily be that feudalism in Pakistan is still so much tied to the land as it is a state of mind, in which you, who are the local elite, believe that you ought to be ruling and that the people who are working on the land ought to stay working on the land, that you don't particularly want their kids going to school, that you don't particularly want them acquiring skills, that you don't want them able to demand higher wages, that you simply want to keep them down and think that somehow the country will progress anyway. I mean, that sort of sums up an attitude that still is there, and it's often said that Parliament in Pakistan is dominated by large landowners and people who sort of come from that background, and they have an enormous amount of influence in establishing policies and laws having to do with land and jobs and all kinds of other things. So until a more progressive mindset is able to advance, I think it's going to remain very difficult to change that balance of power and to reduce that gap we were talking about in response to an earlier question.
Yeah. Here's some interesting questions submitted by someone who sent us an email. Wasn't Pakistan always playing with fire? The fundamentalism was the reason why the minority Hindu population of West Pakistan dwindled from some 15% in 1947 to about 2% now. Besides, the Islamization of the army has been going on at least since General Zia-ul-Haq took over. Even the recently slain Pakistani journalist Shahzad confirms this in his book published before his death. How will the generals who were raised on this doctrine change their army?
Well, that letter has also raised a number of different issues. I guess the most important one to talk about is sort of the conflict that's going on within the army. I don't want to get into everything that happened back in the 1940s and all that, but let's talk about more what's happening now. What has been happening is that officially the army is not religious. I mean, officially it, you know, officers and soldiers are supposed to be, you know, sort of neutral and professional, and it's prided itself always on being a very professional army, and it is. But there has been this kind of creeping religiosity that did start with General Zia, and it has spread more widely through the ranks. And there have, in fact, been incidents in the past few years, although they don't talk about it very much, in which soldiers and officers from various branches of the military have been found to be involved in and arrested for involvement with Islamic militant groups and even, in some cases, terrorist attacks. But that still remains a very small, you know, a few incidents. But it has been, as I said, sort of in response to an earlier question, I would still say that it's been more a question of tolerating and encouraging religious groups as a way of focusing public attention elsewhere, rather than it has been, generally speaking, a desire by the military establishment to become, you know, Islamized. I mean, Pakistan is very, very different from Iran, for example, or Saudi Arabia. It is not a theocracy, and it was not established as one, and I don't expect it to become one anytime soon. You do have very strong institutions in the army, in the civil service. You do have very important centers of power in Pakistan that are not religious. So I think it's a mistake to overemphasize the religiosity of its institutions. I think what's happening is that the religiosity that's growing and the sort of emotional attachment and the defensiveness about Islam is really coming from below, is really coming from the grassroots, is coming from the man in the street who is doesn't have much hope in life, who feels alienated from the state, who feels frustrated politically, who can't get justice in the courts, who can't get his kid into school, who's turning to Islam as his sort of fallback position, who turns and listens to the mullah preaching on Fridays, who may be telling him that, you know, the Americans are bad or the Indians are bad or whatever that speech is. This is bubbling up, not bubbling down.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. I have several questions and listen off the air, and you might have mentioned some of this, but
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Pakistan and China, especially in terms of North Kashmir and what they've done with the border issues, which essentially create conflicts with India and some of the other Buddhist communities like in Ladakh. The issues also with Kashmir and Mumbai bombing, and you might have talked to that. And the last thing is about religiosity. Somewhere I've heard that there used to be, and I don't know if there still is, a strong Sufi Islamic tradition in Pakistan, which has been having major problems because of the majority Sunni. So I will hang up and listen to your response on the air. Thank you.
Great. Well, you've raised some very good questions. I did, I think, before you were listening, talk quite a bit about Sufism and its importance as part of Pakistan's religious tradition of moderation and tolerance, and the important role that the Sufi shrines have played in the society. It's been a very important force for toleration and moderation in the society. And yes, it is also under attack now from more extremist groups. There have been a number of attacks on Sufi shrines all over the country in the past several years, and this is of great concern. I do want to hop back briefly to China. China is not, I don't write about China in my book. I don't deal much with Pakistan-China relations in my book. It's not an area I've studied very much. I certainly know that Pakistan's relation with China has definitely been courted as a direct sort of counterweight to India. And increasingly, as relations between Pakistan and the West begin to fray and become tense, Pakistan is very much reaching out to China again as a counterweight to that. But I don't want to talk more about it because it's really not a subject that I've pursued in detail. On the other hand, I've spent a lot of time working on the Kashmir issue. I've spent a lot of time in Indian Kashmir. I've spent some time in Pakistani Kashmir. I've written a great deal about the Kashmir issue, and it has been, you know, one of the great, you know, to Pakistanis, this is one of the great causes. I mean, you know, Pakistanis are brought up to believe that fighting for the liberation of Kashmir is a sacred cause, and it's something that they are taught that they should aspire to the liberation of Kashmir, and the state has supported guerrilla groups fighting against the Indian army in Indian controlled Kashmir for a number of years now. What has happened over time is that some of these groups have begun to have their ambitions grow wider, and they have metastasized from sort of very narrowly focused on what they call the liberation of Kashmir. And I don't want to talk about the origins of the dispute because, again, that goes back to the 1940s. But what's happened is that these groups have begun to broaden their agenda into what they call a global jihad. And they have been spreading their work throughout India and other places. And the attack that the caller mentioned on the city of Mumbai, which is, you know, India's major financial capital, it's like New York, it's like Sao Paulo, it's a huge, huge and very important city. The attack on Mumbai by a commando group just after Thanksgiving in 2008, in which more than 160 people were killed and mayhem was spread throughout the city, it was a very shocking attack. It turns out that that the masterminds and the commandos who did this were based in Pakistan and were affiliated with one of these groups that had originally been supported by the Pakistan state to fight in Kashmir. And so, again, going back to this notion of playing with fire, you had groups that originally had strong popular and state support, which have now changed, and they have morphed into something else, which is becoming a direct threat to the world, and which the government is really scrambling and struggling to figure out how to control.
Mm. You say traveling around Pakistan, talking to people, the issue of corruption came up all the time. 2011 has seen uprisings in the Middle East and now in India with the anti-corruption campaign of Anna Hazare. How do Pakistanis view these events, and Do they? Does Hazari and his followers resonate?
I can't speak to the last question because he's really become, you know, widely known only very, very recently. Mm-hmm. But I can certainly speak to the issue of corruption and how Pakistanis feel about it. It is very much on their minds. It is something that people talk about all the time. It is one of the main sources of frustration and alienation from the state. And so at the low level, or sort of at the ordinary level, many, many people say, and surveys and polls show this, and as well as, you know, interviews, that people very much resent the fact that they have to pay bribes for all sorts of little transactions for, you know, almost anything. You can't really get anything done in a normal sort of, you know, there's no official price. You know, there's always something under the table. Sort of the way, what people are frustrated by is it's sort of when corruption becomes a way of life, in which, as I say in the book, the victims of it become complicit. And so that's sort of my definition of corruption is when sort of having these routine transactions of extortion and bribery and influence peddling and favoritism becomes such a way of life that everybody knows they have to be part of it. So the ethos or the value or the ability to speak out or rise above it or protest, people don't bother anymore. Another example as you go higher up the ladder is tax collection. You know, Pakistan is famous for people not paying taxes, and I'm talking about rich people, not poor people. I'm talking about businesses. You know, there has been huge amounts of news coverage and publicity and investigation done on, you know, major companies, banks, political parties, political leaders, industrialists, you know, ghost factories, loans without collateral, you know, that never get repaid, you know, people that, you know, are worth billions of dollars who, you know, never pay a cent in taxes. These kinds of scandals are widely known in Pakistan. So who's setting the example? You know, and if you have, you know, all sorts of stories, rumors, reports, and in some cases, you know, actual court cases, you know, of the country's leaders, you know, routinely breaking the law, not believing they have to, you know, pay their taxes or abide by, you know, financial laws. It sets a terrible example for the rest of the country. So the issue of corruption, it also applies very much to the courts. I have a whole chapter on the justice system in which, you know, so many people told me over and over again that you know, if you have a case, if you have a dispute, whether it's over land or whatever, if you don't pay bribes, nobody's going to pay attention to your case. You'll never win. So that the side with the most money and the most influence is expected to win, and that the merits, in many cases, you know, don't matter. So it's it breeds enormous cynicism and enormous frustration, and it's one of the reasons people do turn to Islam. And when polls are done about, have been done about people's attitudes in Pakistan towards the Taliban and towards the idea of bringing in Sharia law, which is very strict Islamic law, many people say that they would prefer it to democracy because they feel it would bring real justice, swifter justice, more honest justice. And this is a very powerful judgment against, you know, the government, the Constitution, and the way things are done.
The taxes that are collected, what is that revenue spent on? I mean, does it go to health? Does it go to education? Where is it going?
Well, I think I discussed this a bit earlier on in the interview, in several questions, actually, the whole problem of the military having such sort of owning such a huge chunk of the national budget has always come at the expense of social spending on health, particularly on schools, on anti-poverty programs. There's really been a very lopsided use of revenue that has favored, you know, these big institutions, particularly the army, over really trying to uplift and empower the human capital of the nation.
Let's take another call. This is a listener indicator. We're coming to the end of the time that we have this morning, but so let's make it brief. Line one, Decatur, hi.
Yes, quickly. We're in a decline of the oil age, and it's going to decline a lot quicker than we think. So my question is, it seems like Pakistan and that whole area is a quagmire. We're not going to be able to support a military operation over there in 20 or 30 years anyway. Why not just pull out and walk away from it? I just thought I'd get your thoughts on it. Thanks.
Okay. So I guess that gets to the issue of, you know, is Pakistan of vital interest to the U.S.?
Right. Although he's asking it much more broadly, and mm-hmm. of course we're talking about, you know, many, many different countries, the American military and economic commitment in Afghanistan mm-hmm. is huge mm-hmm. right now compared, for example, to Pakistan. In Pakistan, you know, we don't have troops. We have been giving a lot of aid, but we're pulling back on it because of our problems now with the military. We've given them a lot of military aid. We're pulling back on that. So at the moment, actually, we are beginning to withdraw some of our support for Pakistan. But yes, we have a huge investment still in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and a number of other places. We've been very involved in supporting the uprisings in places like Libya. To get to Celeste's question, you know, you might ask more broadly, what is our vital interest in the region? Now, what is the region? I mean, if we're talking about the subcontinent, you know, just by virtue of its population alone, the subcontinent, which is essentially India, Pakistan, you know, is one of the world's great population centers with a large growing population. They both have nuclear weapons. They are both, you know, very important economic centers and trading partners. And India is now, you know, very, very booming as a very important American trading partner. India and Pakistan have been at loggerheads and conflict with each other, you know, ever since the 1940s. That conflict needs to be solved. It's absolutely essential that that conflict be solved in order to make sure that there's not another flashpoint for, you know, a world conflagration. Now, when you're talking about the Middle East, you've got different issues there. You've got, you know, a number of countries in which people are revolting against essentially autocratic regimes, you know, Egypt, Yemen, Libya, et cetera. In many ways, that's kind of a different story. Because in Pakistan, remember, you have an elected civilian government. You have a powerful army, but you also have a judiciary, a parliament, presidents and prime ministers. You've got an elaborate political system. The problem is getting to make it work.
And there we'll leave it. Fascinating discussion. Pamela Constable, thank you so much for talking with us this morning.
It's been my pleasure.
Pamela Constable is the author of Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. The publisher is Random House.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our week-long retrospective of some of our favorite entertainment and pop culture interviews of the year with a performance by Gillian Welch and David Rawlings. And we listen back to our interview with David Carr, who writes the Media Equation column for the New York Times. Join us. But the things I seen in Scarlet Town did
mortify my soul. Well, this afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Risk Management Commodities, Lafayette, Indiana; Milo's in Urbana and Escobar's in Champaign; and Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's coming up on noon Central Time. You're tuned to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Let's take a look at commodity prices. In Kansas City, the March wheat contract is trading at 7.02. That's up 6.25. May, 7.11 3/4, up 7.25. March wheat in Chicago, 6.53, up 8.25. The May contract, 6.69 3/4, up 7.75. March corn, 6.42, up 8.75. May, 6.49 3/4, up 8.5. The July contract, up 8.25 at 6.55.5. September, 6.08 1/4, up 7. January soybeans, 12.02 3/4, up 3. March, 12.12 1/2, up 3. May, 12.21 1/2, up 2.25. July, 12.30 3/4, up 2.25. January soybean meal, 310 even, that's up 230. January soybean oil, 51.87, up 3. December live cattle, 122.95, down 30. The February contract, 123, down 20. January feeder cattle, 147.60, up 45. March, 150.40, up 12.5. And February lean hogs, 86.15, that up 40. Outside markets, February crude, 99.69, down 1.65. The U.S. dollar,